Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am tremendously honored today to be able to speak with someone who is certainly a very well-known voice to many, many public radio listeners across the country, Diane Rehm. I have long admired the great work that she has done and very much appreciate a powerful new book which she has just written called When My Time Comes. Conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. There's a lot packed into that title, and the book indeed explores this profound question about when death comes to us at the end of a life, and to what extent we should have a say in the circumstances under which life comes to an end. We're talking in particular about something called medical aid in dying. And we're going to take apart that particular term and talk about the ways in which that can be applied. And indeed, there are states in the country in which this is allowed, medical aid in dying. And there are other places where it is under discussion. And in many quarters, including those places where it is permitted, where there is fierce opposition for one reason or another. In Diane Rehm's book, she talks about this with a number of different people who have perhaps experienced this directly, very personally in their lives, or who are advocates for this practice. And she speaks to at least one opponent to medical aid in dying. And we hear extensively from them as well. This happens to be a topic that is of deep personal concern to Diane Rehm. And we will explore some of those personal dimensions of this as well. The title of the book, once again, which is soon to be, in a sense, converted into a program for PBS, is titled When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. This is a publication of Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. And Diane Rehm, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be with you.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I think probably what makes the most sense is for us to begin with the personal, if you don't mind. If you could, and that's essentially how you begin your book, with an account of why this is an issue that has deep personal resonance with you, and not just because of your own life and the way in which your own life someday may end, but because of a couple of other reasons as well. Explain to our listeners those sort of personal connections you have to this issue.
Beginning with my mother's death at age 49, when I was just 19 years old, she was suffering from liver cancer. And after repeated hospitalizations, she said to me and to her doctors, "I want to die." She was suffering in such a terrible way. She looked as though she were 11 months pregnant, and she had to be drained of fluid, which was terribly painful for her. Her life had literally come to an end as she had known it, had enjoyed it. Of course, my father was suffering as well. Finally, when doctors would not pay any attention to her wishes to die, because back in those days, no doctor did, she finally died. My father died 11 months later of a broken heart. So my life has long been filled with death. My husband's father took his own life at 72 because he lived alone and began to suffer the problem of blindness. He lived alone on a farm and knew he could no longer continue living that way. He took his own life. My mother-in-law, at age 92, after suffering from intolerable back pain, took her own life. So the story of life and death was very much part of our family conversation. And John and I had both agreed we would never allow the other to suffer in ways that were intolerable. But of course, he was in a nursing home with severe Parkinson's disease. He could no longer feed himself. He could no longer stand on his own, do anything for himself. He could not bathe himself or toilet himself. And he felt he had lost all dignity. And he said, if I continue to live this way, I will go further and further into indignity. So after a conversation with his own doctor, where he begged him to help him die, and in the state of Maryland, where it was not allowed, where medical aid in dying was not allowed, and is still not allowed, the only thing John could do for himself was to stop eating and drinking water and taking medication. It took him 10 long days to die, and they were 10 of the longest days of his life and mine. Now, you must understand that the film, the documentary you mentioned that's coming out on PBS in mid-April, this book is based on that documentary. In fact, the documentary came first. And when we were about 1 year into 3 years of creating the documentary, I thought, this needs to have a book to go along with it. So I am both the narrator and the interviewer in that documentary, and this book is presenting about 25 of the 45 interviews that we did for the documentary. And in fact, he talked with three people who are very much opposed to medical aid in dying: a Roman Catholic priest, an African American AME pastor, and a palliative care physician out in Oregon, the very first state that adopted medical aid in dying. So that is the background, Greg.
And I find it interesting that, I mean, I appreciate the fact that you, let's say, pull no punches in terms of being very open about your own perspective here. You do not come to this question without your own opinion, and your opinion is a fervent one, that this is a right that you want to have, and you think others should have the right to embrace if that is their choice. And yet, you obviously have taken careful pains to be fair about this question and to acknowledge that there are others who feel differently about it than you do. How difficult was it for you with an issue about which you feel so passionately to allow room for the other side of this issue?
That's a wonderful question, Greg. I, as you probably know, hosted the Diane Rehm Show for nearly 40 years on WAMU in Washington and NPR. So whenever we did the daily program, there were more than one or even two views. Sometimes there were three or even four views. I have always felt it was important to both present and listen to other views. And you're right, I am passionate about this issue. However, I am passionate about the right for each person to make up his or her own mind. This book is not meant to persuade anyone, but rather to set forth the arguments on both sides of the issue and from many different perspectives. We talked with people who are dying. We talked before the fact with people who have died. We talked with doctors on both sides of this issue. We talked with nurses. We talked with survivors. We talked with loved ones. We talked with a whole range of people that I believe represents the entire feeling throughout the country about medical aid in dying. There are currently 9 states plus the District of Columbia where I live, which now allow medical aid in dying. There are probably 20 states who have this under consideration now. So the debate goes on and will, I'm sure, for quite a while.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Diane Rehm and talking about her latest book, which is titled When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. What we're talking very specifically about is something known as medical aid in dying. Diane Rehm, I think one of the things that is very tricky here, and one thing I appreciate about your book, is that it seeks to bring clarification to many similar terms, and I think help make clear just exactly what we are talking about and some of the safeguards that are put in place when medical aid in dying is practiced. One of the most fundamental questions I think I would like to hear your perspective on is something that comes up in a really interesting chapter in your book, in which you share essentially a lecture given to second-year medical students at George Washington University by someone who is National Medical Director of Compassion and Choices, so someone who is very much an advocate for medical aid in dying. Dr. David Grube, is that how we pronounce that?
It's actually Grube.
Dr. David Grube. One of the things that he says emphatically in this lecture to medical students, trying to get them to understand this, is that he very consciously does not use the word suicide or physician-assisted suicide, because this is not suicide.
This is most definitely not suicide. If I can quote from one of the young women who had stage 4 breast cancer and who has since died, she had a 13-year-old son. She looked at me and said, if I had my druthers, I would live until I'm 90. I don't have a choice. I know I'm going to die. Those who commit suicide make that choice. They decide they no longer want to live. Those who are afflicted with cancer or ALS or some other dread disease do not have that choice. So we're not talking about suicide. Medical aid in dying has very strict parameters, Greg. There have to be at least 2 doctors who agree that the patient is within 6 months of death. In some states, a psychiatric examination is required where the patient and the doctor alone speak about the patient's wish. That is to ensure that there is no coercion from a family member or friend or anyone else. There then have to be 2 weeks after that request is made on the part of the patient for medical aid in dying. There is a waiting period in some states. After those 2 doctors have agreed that this person is within 6 months of death, and then, only then, is that medication given to the patient, and the patient must be able to self-administer. So a doctor doesn't go in and give a shot in the arm. A doctor, most of the time, is not even present. So the idea that this is suicide, you know, just does not make sense.
Another point that is made in that lecture that I think I found quite striking is
Lecture, I must say, I loved that lecture because those young people were so attentive and they asked good questions and engaged with Dr. Grube so beautifully. And then I had a chance to talk with those students afterwards to understand their feelings and what they came to the lecture thinking, and then how the lecture might have affected their thinking. It was very beautiful.
I'm really glad that it's included here. One of the points he makes that I think would be a surprise, at least it was a surprise to me, he says, it's important for you to know that of the people who go through the process, that is those who embrace this process of medical aid in dying, he says only 2/3 of them end up taking the medication. Fully 1/3 who have a prescription do not take it. They just want the option. They want to be empowered to have a choice. They have no choice about being about to die, but they would like to have certain other choices. It seems to me that that's a really important point here, although I'm not even sure just exactly why it's an important point. But it is.
It's such an important point because Even my high school sweetheart, who had a terrible cancer that afflicted his bones, even he, who lives in Colorado or lived in Colorado with his wife of 64 years, he applied for and received the medication. And at the end, when he was in a peaceful state, his wife said, "Would you like the medication?" And he said, "No." And he died without it. So people have explained to me that what having that medication does is to give them a sense of peace and control, knowing that should that point arrive when they can no longer tolerate what they are experiencing, they can then make use of it. But exactly as you said, 1/3 of those who receive the medication do not use it, only 2/3 do. And this is data, consistent data, coming out of Oregon, which was the first state to adopt medical aid in dying and has proved consistent around the country.
I thought this point was brought home very firmly in the chapter in which you speak with Dan Diaz, the widower of Brittany Maynard, and this would be one of the best known cases of someone embracing this medical aid in dying, and we'll talk more about her story in just a moment. But when he describes the moment when his wife received approval for the medications, and he says it provided her an enormous sense of relief, a sense of having just a little bit of control in the midst of the chaos of a brain tumor. So much felt completely out of her control. It was very evident to me how much relief it provided her. Her outlook from that point on was completely different. That fear was gone. She could now focus on living life, not being so terrified of death. I found that so striking, the notion that in a moment, not that her pain was taken away, not that her cancer was taken away, but that which she was the most terrified about, that she might suffer terribly for a long, long time, the fear of that was taken away. And the difference that makes, it's not just that terror is gone, but that it allows room emotionally and mentally for other things to take its place. I just found that to be so powerful, and I never would have thought about this question in those terms until I read his words.
Greg, I'm so glad you read that portion, because I think you're absolutely right. It's not only important and powerful, it gave Brittany a sense of comfort and peace, knowing that when that time came, she had the right to make that decision. She told the world that November 1 of that year might be the day she did it. In fact, as her husband told me, she wasn't absolutely certain that was going to be the day. However, she woke up that morning and immediately had 2 serious seizures. And at that point, she said to Dan, "It's time." She went peacefully. She had her family and her dearest friends with her. at her home, her rental home in Oregon, because at that time, where Dan and Brittany lived in California, at that time, California did not have medical aid in dying, so they uprooted themselves and moved to Oregon, created their residence there, did everything by the rules in order that she could have access to medical aid in dying, which was so important for her.
That is Dan Diaz, spend some time in this chapter talking about the difficulty of doing this. I don't even mean emotionally. I mean, he actually was in complete agreement with his wife that this is what they should do. But the whole matter of uprooting themselves from where they lived, from California to Oregon, in order to be able to do this, Dan Diaz says she, meaning his wife, thought it was a huge injustice that a terminally ill individual, after being told she had 6 months to live, all of a sudden had to go through the process of leaving her home to get across some imaginary line on a map. That in Oregon, she would have the option of a gentle passing, that if we stayed in California, she ran the risk of essentially being tortured to death by her brain tumor. That would be a terrible choice.
Understand that Brittany and Dan had the means by which to do that, something that most people do not. Most people in most states do not have the wherewithal to pull up stakes and move to a state that does allow medical aid in dying. And they did have that wherewithal, but Dan, ultimately, he was going back and forth to California to continue to support his family, to support his wife, to earn a living. How many of us could do that? So right now, 1 in 5 Americans has the right to medical aid in dying. Our hope with both the film and with my book is to urge people to think about this, to talk about this, to talk with their families, to talk with their friends, their neighbors, so that people begin to back away from the fear of death. Death is going to be part of all of our lives. So therefore, to wait until the end when pressure is on and then say, what am I going to do now? We'd like to see people begin to talk about this, and of course, to see state legislatures all over the country begin to talk about this. As I said to you earlier, there are about 20 states currently considering it. The Roman Catholic Church has been the most outspoken organization absolutely opposed to medical aid in dying. And yet more and more nursing groups, more and more doctors' groups are saying, we stand back. We take a neutral position here and feel that if it will move forward in these state legislatures, fine. Whereas the Roman Catholic Church has put millions of dollars into defeating proposals around the country. It's coming up for the fourth or fifth time in Massachusetts, in the state legislature where I have testified. It's coming up again in Maryland where I have testified. And in each case, the Roman Catholic Church is very, very much involved in trying to defeat this option. And I appreciate their thinking. I understand that they believe God should be the only decider. And if you feel that way, you who are listening feel that way, I support you 100%. And if you who are listening feel you want absolutely everything medical science can provide, I support you 100%. It's your choice. And if you feel, as I do, that I would like medical aid in dying at the end of my life, I hope you will support me.
We're speaking with Diane Rehm about her newest book, When My Time Comes, Conversations about Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. And I do want to reiterate that there are several chapters in the book that deal with those who are opposed to the notion, and their opposition is based on a couple of different things. One of them being more about sort of concerns about the implementation of it, or if it is going to be equitably available, and so on, and also philosophical concerns, and so on. So that perspective is amply represented in this book. I appreciated a turn of phrase from the chapter in which you speak with Barbara Coombs Lee, president of Compassion and Choices. And that's an organization I'm not acquainted with, but I assume that they advocate on behalf of medical aid in dying.
It is a very important organization nationwide, and you can Google it. They provide all kinds of information to people who are not only interested in medical aid in dying, but who are searching for assistance when terminal illness presents itself.
One thing she says in her book in terms of how one's life should end is the notion that life should end the way you lived your life, with you in full embrace of your own priorities, whatever those may be. And her concern is that there are many people who, in her words, end up being abducted onto a conveyor belt of medical technology that leads to a robbing of your priorities and a displacement of the things that you value most at the end of life. I think that's a really apt way of describing what I'm sure does happen in many instances when something terrible befalls you, maybe suddenly, unexpectedly, and you're confronted with a bewildering situation and an array of choices you don't understand necessarily, and find yourself indeed on this conveyor belt of medical technology procedures one after another, almost without realizing it. What a sad scenario that is, that I'm sure happens all too often. So what is kind of the nature of the conversations that you want people to have, and with whom, in order to avoid that scenario, if that's a scenario that you don't want to be part of your own end of life?
The first person you need to talk with is within your own family, the person with whom you are closest. Second person would be your children, if they are the ones to whom you are closest. Thirdly, your own physician. I, in fact, had to change my physician, leave my physician, whom I had been with for 8 or so years, because when I asked her whether she would support me in medical aid in dying, she said, no, I don't want to get involved in that. And that was, for me, a deciding moment. So I found a doctor, one of the very few. It's not easy here in Washington, D.C., or anywhere else except California and Oregon, which now have many, many physicians who have agreed to participate in medical aid in dying. Your friends, you must let your friends know what it is you want. Greg, in some parts of the country, we are seeing and experiencing what are called, my mind has gone blank for 1 second.
I bet you're talking about death cafes.
Death cafes, thank you very much. Death cafes have become so popular throughout the country. They are made up of random groups of people within churches, within schools, within neighborhoods who come together and speak with each other about death, about dying, and about what they want at the end of life. And what this does is to minimize the fear of death. It is going to happen to all of us. And to express what we would want at the end of life, no matter what that is, can be such an empowering statement to make to those around you. In those places where neighborhoods themselves have come to hold death cafes, those neighbors know that if an ambulance comes, for example, and a person has said, I am going to have a do not resuscitate statement on file, that statement must be honored. The problem with ordering an ambulance to come is that the ambulance technicians are bound to attempt to resuscitate. So you've got to make a choice. Do you want to, if you feel you're having a stroke, and you're a certain age, if you're having a heart attack, you're of a certain age, and your neighbors know you don't want to be resuscitated, perhaps they should be the ones you call on and not 911. It is a very important decision to make in one's own life.
Interesting. And it's important to let certain people in your life know about this. And towards that end, I want you to explain to our listeners who Benjamin is and what we find in the last chapter, the very last chapter, I think, of your book, When My Time Comes.
And Benjamin is my darling grandson. He is now a junior at Dartmouth. I asked him while we were filming for the documentary here in my apartment, and he happened to be visiting me. What 19-year-old wants to come and visit his grandmother? I adore him, and we have a great time together. I asked him to record me on his cell phone as I explained my wishes not to be kept alive under any circumstances should I begin to develop Alzheimer's. I want to be told by him, by my daughter, his mother, by his uncle, my son. I want to help them understand that I will not live through an entire cycle of Alzheimer's. And as he was filming me on his cell phone, he was being filmed by our own film producer. And so that part of it is in the film. And he was so darling and so responsive. He's a great kid, and I'm sure has shared that video from his camera with my daughter, my son, and everyone who needs to know it.
I want to just read to close one part of what you shared with your grandson, Benjamin, and it's something that was written by Anne Morrow Lindbergh that you said just beautifully encapsulates your own wishes. So Anne Morrow Lindbergh wrote quite a number of years ago, of course, to my family, my physician, and my hospital, if there is no reasonable expectation of my recovery from mental or physical disability, I request I be allowed to die and not to be kept alive by artificial means and heroic measures. I ask that medication be mercifully administered for me for terminal suffering, even if it hastens the moment of my death. I hope that you who care for me will feel morally bound to act in accordance with this urgent request. And you go on to say, so that's what Anne Morrow Lindbergh wrote. And when I read that, I thought, wow, that's exactly how I feel. I deeply appreciate the all of the information and also the personal honesty and openness with which you have written this book, When My Time Comes. To finish out today's morning show, I want to read to you the final portion of the preface to Diane Rehm's book, When My Time Comes. This is after she has recounted the story that you already heard in the interview of the ordeal she experienced when she had to watch her mother suffer in December of 1955, suffering from cirrhosis of the liver. As a child of six, and for many years thereafter, I can recall saying to my mother, I want to die before you do. I don't want to live without you. Deep in my heart, I'd known she wasn't well, and I feared being left behind. To then have had to watch her suffer for so long became the beginning of my passionate belief in the right to die. It began while watching my mother in her agony, feeling so angry that doctors could do nothing to help ease her way into the inevitable. I kept wondering why she had to suffer, why she could not simply be put out of her misery when there was no cure in sight. Of course, back in 1955, there were no liver transplants being performed and no right-to-die laws in place anywhere in the country. It was not until 1998 that Oregon became the first state in the country to adopt such a law. The state of Washington followed in 2009, Montana by a court case in 2009, Vermont in 2013, California in 2015, Colorado in 2016, the District of Columbia in 2017, Hawaii in 2018,
and New Jersey and Maine in 2019. Just 9 states plus the District of Columbia, where individuals are permitted to choose when to cease their suffering through the use of medical aid in dying. Now numerous state legislatures are in fierce debate among those who believe, as I do, that each of us has the right to choose when our suffering should end, and those who argue, on religious or moral or ethical grounds, that no human being has the right to hasten an individual's death. The opponents define the right to die as suicide. Other countries, such as Switzerland and the Netherlands, have long had laws allowing doctors to respond to requests of individuals to end their lives, some because of physical illness, others due to severe emotional distress. For the past 2 years, I have interviewed many people, patients with terminal illnesses, doctors, nurses, ethicists, and those left behind. They told stories of their journeys through end-of-life preparation, shared their perspectives, and spoke honestly of their beliefs, hopes, and fears. Most will appear in the television documentary When My Time Comes, a companion to this book. Both the book and the film are meant to shed light on the reality of medical aid in dying, the process, who is eligible, what it means for those people who have been approved, the feelings of physicians involved, as well as the thoughts of those left behind. Those of us who have worked together on the documentary have one goal in mind: to urge a discussion of death, a topic so many fear to mention. This is true in too many families where the subject of death is never brought up until it's too late, when the reality of a loved one's illness leaves children or siblings with no understanding of what the individual might want. Legal documents indicating do not resuscitate or use no artificial means to sustain life are not enough. What is required is talk, real, honest-to-goodness talk, not only with family, but also with doctors, ministers, and friends. What do you want when you are near the end of life? Do you wish to die in a hospital after being kept alive by machines and ventilators, with every last medical option being applied to your body? Or do you wish to die at home, in your own bed, surrounded by family and comforted by a caring physician who has provided you with the medication to end your suffering when you decide you have had enough? Those are the conversations I pray this book and the documentary will spur. When those talks reach state legislatures, when the men and women who make such decisions are persuaded of the legitimacy of the individual's right to determine the time for life to end, we will be more at ease in the belief that death is an integral part of life. That was a portion of the preface to the book When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End, the book by Diane Rehm, with a foreword by best-selling author John Grisham. The book is published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation from actually several years ago, but just as timely as ever, about racism, with a former faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology. This weekend, the podcast version of The Morning Show will include a conversation that I recorded back in the late 1990s with a Racine native named Bob Kettleson, who actually went on to become one of the most renowned opera coaches in the world, working at La Scala and the Paris Opera. And this conversation, which I just uncovered a couple of days ago, will be replayed on the Saturday podcast of The Morning Show. Subscribe by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. The time is exactly 9 o'clock. Support for The Morning Show comes